So it's July 3rd. This is episode 43 of The Job. Jesse Angham is our guest. First, how excited are you, Candace, to learn some Git?
Me? I'm thrilled. Yeah. You probably know it better than me, so maybe you know I should be dreading it, but as of yet, I'm not. Okay, here's what I'm dreading. I'll admit, you mentioned that to learn to make a change on a website where, let's say, I already understand HTML and CSS and all of that.
Yeah.
You mentioned putting on 4 1-hour
yeah.
presentations. And there's just this part of me that feels like it can't be that hard. Like, there should be some way to sit down together for 15 minutes and then, not, like, that's what I'm dreading. The fact that it would take 4 1-hour sessions to learn how to use this tool where all I need to do is change code that I already know how to change if that tool wasn't blocking me from doing it. That doesn't feel like a useful tool to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm exactly. curious about how this helps our studio, but you believe in it very strongly, and I'm sure that it's the right thing. But I'm just kind of like, could you call it down to like a 45-minute presentation?
It's funny because I feel like when I think about trying to explain this in 4 hours, I think we are just going to scratch the surface. That's like a minimum, I think, time I need to explain how to just make simple changes to code and get them back on the servers.
So tell me, given that this tool, we're using it in our studio because we believe that it's helpful.
Yeah.
Why is it so hard to explain? If it's here to make our lives easier, how does it make our... Answer me this. How does it make our lives easier? This, so far, being on the other side of the wall, it seems like it doesn't.
Sure. Well, one...
But I'm not against using it. I just don't really, you know...
There's many reasons. And I think... I would start by saying that in the past, we basically used to use Dropbox, and we essentially just kept the websites we were developing in Dropbox and felt like, well, this is great because if we accidentally delete a file or make a bad change, you can see an old version of the file. You can actually go back. Dropbox keeps a history of changes to a file.
Mm-hmm.
And this worked well for a year or two until... we started feeling like there were limitations. For example, there was no easy way to see the differences between these changes in files, for one thing. For another thing, there was no easy way to keep track of changes that different people were making to a file. If you and I both tried to work on a file, it would totally screw everything up.
Mm-hmm.
Another problem is that there's no concept of essentially more than one timeline. So if I'm working on a set of features that are going to touch a bunch of files and change a bunch of stuff, someone else is working on a feature or bug fixes. Like maybe I'm working on a project. Well, you're like, I just need to change some lines of code. If you do that while I'm working on the same set of files in the same timeline, it will screw me up. But if we're working on separate timelines and then we have an orderly managed way to merge in those changes and keep people accountable for the code that they've written,
mm-hmm.
it's much better. That's just a few reasons.
It's really,
I can't imagine our process building websites working without Git anymore. Yeah. I can't even imagine it. But the problem is that you're expressing is that you have... over the years, gotten comfortable with just making a simple change to a file on a server. And now if you just go and do that, it will get overwritten when we deploy our changes to that server because of our new process.
I don't do that.
Right.
Yeah.
there's also nowhere for you just on your computer to go and edit the file in Dropbox like you used to, because now everything's in Git. Mm-hmm. The thing is, in order to understand enough Git just to be able to do the little basic things, you have to understand all that shit I just explained. Like, you have to actually understand how multiple timelines work.
But that seemed pretty straightforward and succinct, and in my mind, and I may be oversimplifying, we would sit down at a computer and you would say, this is how you make a new timeline or branch or whatever it is. And it just boggles my mind how we're going to have to spend 4 hours. Like, give me a book. But if it's going to be like classroom style, to get out of sitting and listening to you give a 4 hour like presentation.
It's not 4 hours at once.
I love you, but it just doesn't sound like fun at all. What can we do to get out of that? Like, you're gonna get so mad if I pick up my phone and look at Instagram. And I'm I will fidget. Okay, so here's the thing: when I was in school, grad school, the one thing I realized about myself is that I have a hard time just sitting in a room, you know, hands on lap, staring forward. And
I'm not asking that of you.
And even like taking notes. You're welcome to doodle, draw. So taking notes is kind of that thing where you're just writing down what they're saying, but it doesn't actually necessarily help. You don't go back and read them.
Yeah, you don't want
to. So what I found is if I was like drawing or somehow other, like artistically engaged, the information would flow through, but it would seem like I wasn't listening, but I was actually listening more. And I just picture myself like sitting at a desk, like fidgeting and like wanting to pick up my phone, and like, you know, the phones are ringing and you're like talking, like, I don't know, I have this.
This droning on, and this node connects to the tree, and this commit, and this branch.
We spend a lot of time together. I don't know that you'd want to see me give a 4 hour presentation on anything right now.
Focus on the fact that it's just, I just want 1 hour.
Four times.
Well, we'll see how the first hour goes. Maybe I'll get to it all.
Yeah. You should have started with that.
Okay. I will.
Yeah.
Start with 1 hour.
But yeah, I do know how to read, and I would be happy to do it if that would be helpful.
Maybe we should do the first hour today.
Oh my God. You're going to kill me.
You can do it right now over Voodoo Donuts.
Oh, that's right. We get donuts today.
Yeah, let's go get donuts.
We get donuts.
Okay. Jesse, where are you from?
I was born in Vernon, British Columbia, Canada, in 1973. That's in the Okanagan Valley. Beautiful area of land.
Wait, say that again. Where are you from?
Vernon, British Columbia.
Okay.
Is where I was born. Lived there for the first 7 or 8 years, I think.
Okay.
It's in the Okanagan Valley in British Columbia. Beautiful area. Well worth a visit if you feel like seeing some land and mountains and lakes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When did you move here? When did you become an expatriate?
We moved here when I was going into first grade. So would that be like 6 years old, 7 years old?
Have you lived in the States since?
Yeah. Apart from a couple years
ago. Because you don't have any accent that I've noticed.
Yeah, that's something you learn pretty quickly to ditch as a, you know, as an elementary school student.
As a beat-upable kid.
Yes, exactly. Spent a couple of years out of the country just traveling, but otherwise have lived in the U.S. since then.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. I should have brought a pen for notes. Hold on.
I probably got one here.
I like a little spontaneity. Because I don't have a pen, why don't you tell me about when you were out of country so I don't have to remember that for later.
Sure. So I had the opportunity to travel to Japan when I was 16, a private high school in Tokyo wanted to kind of expose their students to foreign students, kind of expand the cross-cultural opportunities there. And so they hosted two American students at the time, that year, and I applied to do that.
Okay.
And wrote an essay and corresponded with them a couple of times and did do that. It was awesome.
So like an exchange program kind of thing.
Yeah. There wasn't, I don't think nobody came in my stead.
Oh, I see.
I think that's a traditional formula.
Right. So it's more of a hostage situation. I'm just kidding. Okay. Totally. So when you say when you came to the States, was it Portland or where did you go then?
Eastern Oregon. Okay. So small town called Umatilla.
Okay.
So was there and through elementary school.
Umatilla, it just sounds like it has a nuclear reactor.
Umatilla?
Yeah.
There's one on the Washington side of the Columbia River.
Okay.
Called Hanford.
Okay. Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
That's the one that'll probably get us, huh?
It was decommissioned and they're cleaning it up, which will probably be centuries. I don't know how long
it'll take.
But, some sort of retention ponds, I think, that are still being cleaned up.
What's the nearest city to where you grew up? Like, is there somewhere you'd go to hang out? Everyone had one.
Yeah, it could have been Hermiston, which is probably also, that was, I don't know, that's probably like, at the time was 12,000 people. Now it's 17 or 18 maybe, or maybe 20. Pendleton was the biggest city in the area at the time.
Okay.
And I went to high school there, 3 years of high school.
Okay. Do you know that the Beach Boys were originally the Pendletones?
No, and what would be the basis for that?
They liked that it was cool in Southern California to wear Pendleton sweaters. That was the look. Wow. That was, if you look on their album covers, they're always wearing those. That was the name they wanted. It was some kid at the record company decided that the Beach Boys would be catchier and just literally changed the name without their knowledge. So if not for some punk at Columbia.
Without their knowledge.
Or Capitol, rather. Yeah, literally. Yeah. And they were like, okay, well, the record's pressed.
By the way.
Beach Boys, that's fine. Because they were, I don't know, because they did beach songs. So they're now, you know, a little Pendleton trivia.
That's hilarious.
So what happened between then and Portland? Did you...
Let's see, I went to school, dropped out of school, traveled around Central and South America with my brother for a year.
Did you do a lot of yahi?
Pardon?
Yahe? Isn't that like a... Did you do a lot of drugs?
No.
Oh.
Oh, Yahweh?
Or Yahweh, maybe? I don't know. No, that's like God.
Yeah, maybe. I don't... Let's see.
I read too much William S. Burroughs.
Okay. Yeah. No... Well, some, I suppose.
I'm determined to derail this interview because just for the listeners out there, I've already had a couple drinks. So.
Sorry. No, you know, I mean, I've never been that much into drugs, casually, I suppose.
Sure.
During that time, absolutely.
Yeah, casual.
You know, lots of marijuana during that time.
But, right. South America.
Yeah.
Kicking back.
When in Colombia. I guess that would be a different drug.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't know. So why did you come to Portland? What makes Portland special?
Let's see. Actually, I had a funny experience that led directly to Portland. So my brother and I were working, saving up money to go down to Central and South America.
Mm-hmm.
And I was playing the bass, as I do still.
Mm-hmm.
And living in a duplex, split-level duplex. So I was practicing one night. This is shortly, like within weeks before we were going to leave for the trip. And apparently there was somebody downstairs even though the cars were gone. So somebody was downstairs. I was disturbing their peace. And knock at the door, and it was a policeman. And the policeman issued me a ticket for... playing the bass.
Wow.
It wasn't audible outside, but apparently it disrupted the downstairs neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
I got a ticket, and I forgot about it. I didn't even really try to blow it off, but I left the country without responding to the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Had a great trip, came back and was in Pendleton and looking for jobs. And at this point, I spoke Spanish and Japanese. So I applied for a job at the county jail as an interpreter and went through one interview successfully. And at the second interview was arrested.
Never heard that story.
Which was a surprise. At first, I actually thought this is a psychological test.
Sure.
What do I do under stress?
And right, right.
But no, they, through the first, going through the due process, discovered that I had a warrant for my arrest because I didn't respond to this ticket for playing the bass too loud in a shared living situation. So, and then that's when I pretty much, for better or worse, decided I didn't want to live in Pendleton.
Okay.
Even though it didn't really have anything to do with the experience of living in Pendleton, it's something about it. So I decided I wanted to move. And so I dealt with the ticket and within a week had shacked up in a friend's apartment and it started the transition. And started working at a bakery, local bakery that I'm not even sure that's still open, Three Lanes Bakery, but it was pretty big for a while.
Where was this?
It was on 5th and Davis.
Okay.
Here in Northwest.
Sure.
I
vaguely remember that.
And I worked the swing shift. I was a principal baker and like did pastries and croissants and bread and cakes, that sort of thing. And that's how I started moving to Portland. That's when I started living in Portland.
Portland. I'm still the lookout here. Mm-hmm. Okay. So is that the first job you had in Portland was mm-hmm. baker? Okay. And yeah. Then where did you go from there in Portland?
Yeah. Let's see. Decided that the restaurant business didn't make sense. So I worked at restaurants and bakeries.
Okay.
Here in Portland and before that. Started two at that point. A bakery and a restaurant.
Okay.
Yeah. But I learned through that process that like margins are razor thin.
Yeah.
And even if you're an integral part of the business but don't own it, you still don't make that much money and you're going to work lots of evenings and weekends.
What type of restaurant did you open? What was this project here?
Yeah, so let's see. There were two bakeries and one restaurant at that point. And the restaurant was in Guatemala on the trip that my brother and I took. So there was a German couple that we met in Guatemala where we were running a bar. And this couple wanted to open a restaurant. They had worked in restaurants but didn't know that much about them.
Okay.
And I helped them like kind of set up a menu and the kitchen and did some guest cooking, but just like helped them get the ball rolling. It worked well within a few months. What's the question?
What kind of restaurant was this?
Oh, what kind of restaurant? So it was pretty standard European fare. I mean, they were Germans.
Okay.
And we were working with what was available at the farmer's market.
I see.
But produce, the growing season's great in that part of the world, you know.
Were the bakeries there as well?
There was one of the bakeries was there. One bakery was in Pendleton.
Okay.
And then there was another restaurant here in Portland.
Okay.
The bakeries were all basically like European style, mm-hmm. like pastries and breads and cakes and stuff like that. Muffins, cookies. The second restaurant was on PSU's campus, and that was heavily weighted towards seasonal and local foods. And so whatever was grown or could be grown, like in a greenhouse or outdoors here, is what we focused on. Mostly vegan and vegetarian, but you know, some meats carefully selected.
Was this like through the school, like to get on campus, or was it?
Right. So basically, an organization formed that wanted to create a sustainable, student-run collective restaurant.
Okay.
And it wasn't associated with an academic program, but this.
Were you a student at the time, or
I was a student? Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And this organization had a board and an executive committee, and they hired me to take it basically from like business plan to the running restaurant. And so I outfitted the kitchen with equipment and hired staff and wrote the menus and that sort of thing. Let's see. So
how long ago was this?
This was like 12 years ago.
Okay. Okay.
13 years ago.
Yeah.
What is this? 2014. So it was 14 years ago. And
wow.
Yeah. So I just, I'm still really tempted to do, I still think about the idea of creating a restaurant or a deli of some sort. But it's a high risk way to live.
Yeah. Super high risk.
And yeah,
it's easy to focus on the, you know, some people in Portland have been enormously successful, but it's really hard. It's hard to predict when a place opens.
Yeah.
If that's going to happen.
Well, and the caliber here is so high, and right, there are so many good places. You know, it's a tremendous amount of work and risk, and I assume that the payoff is proportionate to the work.
I swear if one of these people went to Salem and did what people do here, they'd just hit it out of the park. It's like, mm-hmm, hit a Salem and it's a dramatically different story.
Yeah.
There isn't a good restaurant in Salem.
Really?
In my opinion.
Yeah, I've only been there a couple times and it struck me the same way.
But it's like the state capital as far as I've last day.
Yeah, checked. You'd think there would be the clientele to support.
Right, right, right. There's like a fat cats.
Yeah.
On their, I don't know what they call those. But
But part of the reason why Portland restaurants are successful, or at least the ones that we're kind of thinking about here, is that they're, you know, there's a broad base of customers who want, sure, the quality and want the variety and, you know.
And I've kind of come to expect that over the last decade, you know. Yeah. It's, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm cognizant of the fact that if you opened, Ava Jean's in Salem, right, people actually wouldn't go there.
Yeah, that could be.
It actually has to be in Portland.
Yeah.
Or probably Brooklyn. Do you feel like you yourself have strong opinions about food? Do you think that's why a restaurant is something that's always kind of in your mind?
Yeah, it's probably strong opinions. So, you know, I think I experienced this with music and with food.
Similar things, I think. Yeah,
yeah, there are dimensions that are, yeah. So you see what's around, mm-hmm, and then you imagine what could be. You see the problems with what's in front of you, or you see opportunities for something a little cooler, a little more of this, a little more of that. And then I imagine what it would be. Or, you know, but one of the things that I realize that I can do is do that on a very, very small scale at home. You know, like I can experiment with charcuterie or some dish in my living room without risking kind of healthcare, access to healthcare, or, you know, or income, you know, and that sort of thing. So I've basically decided that the things that I'm, these sort of flights of interest and fantasy, I'll sort of execute in smaller scales on the side.
Do you have, so when we go to a restaurant, my wife, whom you've met, has strong opinions about how a kitchen is run. And so she can't face the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
In a restaurant, or she'll be constantly distracted. Do you have that problem?
I'm distracted with
that. Do you recognize the symptoms of that? Like that it's,
yeah.
It's a really polarizing thing to...
For me, it draws my attention and I want to look at it like a TV almost. You know, I get kind of sucked into seeing what's there. And so it's not... I become bad dinner company, I suppose, in that case.
Right.
Yeah.
That happens to me if there's a TV, but
right. it's very exactly. different. For thing. Me, it's the same yeah. thing, kind of. Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people would say that they are, and I could arguably even say this myself. I was a vegan, I was a vegetarian, I've gone through all these ridiculous phases, but although I eat meat, I've never actually killed and eaten an animal. Mm-hmm. Do you have opinions about this?
Yeah, that's... Well, I think it's an intensively personal set of dynamics. I bow hunted for 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
For elk and deer and rabbit. And, you know, it's difficult. It's a difficult process to kill an animal and to gut it. It also seemed like an act of responsibility. Since I chose to eat meat, I was going to participate in that process.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go to the point of saying that other people should do that, because, you know, each person has to sort of find their place in relating with the globe of
sure.
dynamics at play there.
But for you.
But yeah, I mean, for me, it seemed like if I'm going to, yeah, that it was an act of responsibility to participate in that process if I chose to, you know. I was also vegetarian for close to 10 years and vegan for a portion of that.
So is this before the first time you bow hunted, or were you a vegetarian for a period after that?
No, since being a vegetarian.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
And how, like, I mean, thinking back to the first time you did that, what was that experience like? Was it...
It was a really sad process, because one of the most important things to do as a hunter is to really slow your mind, and you're in the woods. In this particular case, we're in the Coast Range, sneaking around, slowing our mind, you know, trying to slow the mind so that we can really pay attention to our senses, because we're ultimately hunting a critter, an animal that can see, hear and smell better than we can.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's pretty much the tools we have to find them. We can track them, but ultimately when it comes to making a kill, to making a good shot, you have to have the advantage in those regards, because if they do sense you in one way or another, then they'll just run off and you'll be, that's it. Okay. So, you have to slow your mind and really pay attention to your senses, and the world opens up in a way when you do that. It's a gorgeous place. Even where there are lots of clear cuts in the Coast Range, you just see beauty all around you. And there's something majestic about elk and deer, even rabbits in a way, in that setting, or elsewhere in a park or whatever. It's generally, you know, hunting is, in my experience, a prolonged process. It's hours and days of methodical, contemplative letting go of your thoughts and just intense focus. And so then you encounter something majestic like this. You know, I don't see how a person can't be reverent for that creature. And so then to take its life, that's, it's a intense process. And then there's just the physicality of gutting it and skinning it, and then the physicality of like putting it on your back and hauling it out of whatever ravine that you hiked into to follow this creature. It's a very intense and deeply personal process.
Is that why you would use a bow rather than like a rifle or something, or a gun? I mean,
That was for me a choice of, as it were, being closer to the ground. And I don't know. I mean, I can't say that. It was evening the tables a little bit between hunter and prey, but there's that dimension to it for me, I guess. I used a compound bow, not a traditional long bow. So I'm not really extreme in the traditionalist side of things. I've got a coworker who makes his own arrows and arrowheads and uses a traditional bow and whatnot. Much less accurate than a compound bow. So like it's, mm-hmm. it's even a more extreme example of that type of thought.
What is it? This is inside baseball. What is the difference between a compound bow and like a crossbow? Is that the same thing?
So a crossbow is essentially two limbs and a string that are mounted to a gun stock.
And essentially, you pull a trigger and it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And there are provisions for hunting with crossbows in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And then a bow. The difference between a traditional bow and a compound bow is mechanical advantage. So a compound bow has pulleys, essentially, that
okay.
you pull a couple of inches, and that's the highest tension of the bow. And for hunting in Oregon, the minimum tension, the weight of that pull, has to be 50 pounds
okay.
or greater. But then as you pull to full length, so you have the string by your ear and your the other arm at full extension, then the weight is considerably lighter, okay? In contrast, the traditional bow, the weight increases as you pull back. So when mm-hmm. when you're at full extension with a traditional bow, the weight is at its highest. And when you're trying to aim a bow, holding little tension is much easier than holding high tension, of course.
Like your arms aren't shaking
exactly.
from the stress.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a much easier form of hunting
okay.
with a compound bow. So, yeah, I don't know. I stopped hunting when my firstborn was born.
Uh-huh. You see yourself doing it again?
I'd like to go back to it.
Well, fishing.
I fished a fair amount as a kid, like fly fished. My dad got us into like tying flies and angling and stuff. I feel like it's, I would enjoy doing it. And I do like once or twice a year probably. And now that I've got two young boys, I could see that being a nice pursuit for us. At Mother's Day, our eldest Jude wanted to give Lacey a fishing pole. So we did. So, you know, we're going to fold that more into our like summer activities.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that much about it.
Goes great with camping.
Totally. Yeah. And there's lots of really, really good fishing, rivers and lakes in Oregon. So
should be thankful for that. I am. While it lasts here.
Right.
So what do you do for a living now? Where's Jesse now?
Yeah. I work for the city of Gresham, the Department of Environmental Services. I work in the water program, and so the broad umbrella of what I do is to work to demonstrate the city's compliance with state and federal drinking water regulations. So every water provider, you know, the city provides water to the community,
mm-hmm.
most of Gresham, and you know there are a handful of state and federal requirements. More than a handful, that each water provider must comply with. And a lot of my time is focused on ensuring that we do meet those expectations.
Okay.
So some of that is doing outreach around water efficiency, water conservation. It's a national requirement that basically all water providers must conduct some conservation outreach to the public.
Okay. What form does it usually take? Like, I know that, and everyone does get a water quality report, you know, yeah. annually or whatever. Like, yeah. Is that part of that?
Yeah. I'm the project manager for that piece.
Okay.
And then conservation could be information about, you know, efficient appliances that you can install in your house or ways to approach managing your yard. Like what plants to plant, how to water, that sort of thing. Or it could be like working with businesses to help them to reduce water consumption. You know, so there are lots of opportunities for that. And
I saw, oh my gosh, I'm not going to, hopefully I can find it. I saw a gentleman this morning speak at the Portland Creative Mornings, the Portland chapter of Creative Mornings. And he was a, he's advocating for changing the way that people relate to their, the grid that cities are built on. And one of the things that he was trying to do was, let's see, Mark Lakeman.
I have met Mark. I know him, yeah.
Okay. So one of the things that he was talking about was having neighborhoods where, like, things like gray water within a block passed between houses and was sort of shared as a resource. Mm-hmm. But he mentioned in passing that an aspect of that was not technically legal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What the hell did he mean?
So the state sets – so there's a national layer of plumbing code uh-huh. that regulates how people use water and drinking water and wastewater, gray water, black water. And then states can add a layer of more stringent standards or certain opportunities where they're justified by engineering, good engineering. Oregon has, I would say, reasonably progressive stance towards the use of gray water and black water
mm-hmm.
or management of it. but it gets tricky when you're crossing properties and involving multiple owners.
Mm-hmm.
Today I was downstairs at the U of O Extension office mm-hmm. Helping with a day-long seminar on water sustainability. And one of our presenters, I was one of four presenters, is talking about eco-districts and basically creating utility districts that are smaller scale than, say, a whole municipality. So it could be 10 by 20 blocks, or it could be five buildings, or it could be three buildings. And there definitely are ways to do exciting things on that scale.
Mm-hmm.
But because stuff like that doesn't have a long history in modern code interpretation,
mm-hmm.
you have to do a lot of work to demonstrate that it can work and it won't make people sick and it won't contaminate waterways,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so Tom Putman was the co-presenter for the seminar today, and he demonstrated or talked about some of the projects he's been working on. One of them is actually quite near here, the Lloyd District. We're talking about two or three buildings that are going to be using, you know, he will install wastewater treatment facilities, of course, not at a city scale, but at several building scale or a 10-block scale, where the output of a wastewater treatment facility installed in a building mm-hmm. or installed in a park or a sidewalk is a source of water for non-potable use. And so perhaps you can take that wastewater and instead of sending it to the wastewater treatment plant, you can use it to flush toilets or irrigate landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so...
Is that called gray water? What kind of water is that?
Yeah, so gray water, basically the difference, you have three main classes of water as far as Oregon Plumbing Code is concerned. You have potable drinking water, you have gray water and black water. So gray water, as it's defined locally, has a low nutrient load. That's basically the difference between gray and black water.
Mm.
So gray water could be what goes down the drain after you wash your hands.
Okay.
After you take a shower.
Okay.
You know, whereas what you use, the water going out of a toilet, mm-hmm. that would be black water because it has a high nutrient load.
Okay.
Out of a dishwasher, because there's food on plates or bowls, that has a higher nutrient load. And so the gray water can be used for a variety of uses. There's a matrix that I presented today to the class that describes the regulatory framework for using gray water. There are three tiers, and there are also three types. Classifications that are based on the origin of the gray water. Is it, you know, single family or duplex? or is it multifamily and commercial, or is it something bigger than that? That loosely defines the three types, and that also corresponds to the volume that you might be putting out. And then there are also three tiers, and that largely corresponds with how you want to use the gray water. So the most relaxed tier, the easiest tier thresholds to meet would be like in-ground infiltration. Mm-hmm. You're not going to send gray water in this scenario. You're not going to send gray water to the water treatment plant. You're going to infiltrate it on site. You're going to use natural in-ground biological processes to clean the water, mm-hmm. and it'll eventually become groundwater, or it'll flow into surface water like lakes or rivers. The second tier might be that you could create a pond with it. So it's something that humans can interact with, but it's obviously not potable,
right?
And it's not going to be airborne. Okay, the third and the most stringent tier would be, you know, you could pipe it through sprinklers, and it could be airborne. So basically you have degrees of rigor in cleaning the water, okay? Mm-hmm. So the x-axis of that matrix is degrees of rigor in cleaning the water. The y-axis basically corresponds to how much you generate.
So the lesson here is don't use shit in your sprinkler.
That's a good rule of thumb, I would say.
When we were, one of our clients at Needmore is Hammer in Hand, and we visited them in Seattle, and they're in a place called the Bullet Center. Have you heard of this place? It surprises me actually, because it's interesting. I can't remember exactly how they described it, but it might be the most ecologically resourceful buildings in the United States. I think it generates all of its own energy on the premises. Like, wow. The solar panels actually stick out from the roof a little bit because they needed that. What you're describing as black water is actually recycled and within the building in the mm-hmm. basement. Mm-hmm. And all this, I mean, we sort of looked around the building and it's pretty crazy, but is this kind of a thing that's coming around in Portland? And is there a motivation to do this? Is there like an economic incentive? Is it just, is it like a Good Samaritan kind of thing? Is it like to save the planet, or what's the motivator here?
You know, that's a highly local thing. Within the Portland metro area, there are 22 separate water providers. Mm-hmm. Okay. Each of those water providers has a different relationship with the infrastructure that they have installed over time and maintained or not.
Right.
They could have a different configuration of drinking water sources. To your question, Portland has a relatively abundant supply in the Bull Run watershed.
Right.
Okay. Per capita consumption over the last 5 or 8 years is actually declining. I'm not sure
exactly. Probably thanks to the Willamette Week's worst offenders list. If anything,
yeah, that could have played a role, definitely. Yeah.
Interesting. It's declined.
Yeah, it's declining, and I think the best guesses are that most of that can be attributed to more efficient fixtures. So, in the early '90s, it was required nationally that the largest flushing toilet that will be available on a residential scale will be 1.6 gallons.
Okay.
And so it takes some time for older toilets to be replaced, right?
Right.
You know, and there are still plenty of toilets that flush that were installed 30, 50 years ago that flush at 3.5 or 5 or 7 or 8 gallons per flush, right?
I see.
So we're seeing now that fixtures, and it's not just toilets, it's shower heads and faucets and aerators. All of those more efficient fixtures are entering homes. There has been a huge transition in terms of the personal sense of responsibility and ethic in the United States, obviously in urban centers like Portland, but even in more rural areas. The attitudes now versus 10, 15 years ago are far more friendly to conservative idea or water
conservationist, let's say, not conservative.
Yeah, yeah, not conservative ideas are alive and kicking in certain places, but yeah, to resource conservation is way less fringe now than it was 10 years ago. And so, you know, you see water use reflecting that. But, you know, you could look at, Tigard or Lake Oswego or Tualatin Valley Water District, and they are investing massively in developing water sources and the infrastructure to support that. And so in those districts, those water utilities have far more robust conservation outreach programs. They have far better funding for, like, rebates to incentivize low-flow toilets or irrigation controllers or pre-rinse spray nozzles for commercial kitchen, like dishwashers. So Seattle, you know, I don't know what their water supply situation is like. My gut says that that is more an ideologically driven thing. Like, that's a company who says, let's be as efficient as possible, be as resourceful as possible, you know.
Different if it was in L.A.,
right. I mean, yeah, Southern California at large is suffering major water shortage issues.
I mean, it seemed like... Okay. Enough about water. Ironically, we're drinking whiskey, and some of your favorite things in this world are things that have had the water removed.
Oh, yeah.
You see what I did there?
Yeah.
I thought, pursuant to this conversation, I should remind you that using heat or mechanics to concentrate fermented liquids is not yet lawful in the United States.
Okay.
Although I assume that it's lawful for some people, but it might not be lawful for you or I. Curious to know your opinion on that.
Yeah, that, I think that sucks. Australia, New Zealand, Canada... probably other countries, Western countries, modern countries, can...
A lot of differences between those, but yes, among those.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we can't distill wine or beer. That seems to be a holdout from Prohibition. 1933, that was lifted. But the federal government, as I understand it, allowed... the home production of wine and beer at that time.
Prior to Prohibition?
No. Upon repealing the
Volstead. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so the Volstead Act made it illegal to actually own and buy it.
Well, kids, ask your parents. Yeah. Volstead Act.
Yeah. but 1933, I think that's a legacy that we are living with now.
Yeah, among others. I mean, it might be hard to argue medicinal use there, but...
Actually, on my office wall, I've got a prescription form that was produced during Prohibition that would allow a physician or a pharmacist who probably operated a soda shop to prescribe alcohol for medicinal purposes, curative purposes. I'll send that to you.
We should bring that back.
It's lovely, yeah.
So while we're on that topic, do you have a favorite drink?
You know, I'm pretty situational.
Okay.
I love rye whiskey. I love scotch, some scotches. I tend towards the Islas, the like big peaty scotches.
Okay.
Lagavulin is probably one of my favorites, but you know, it's not a drink for all occasions.
Right. No, it's not. Scotch can throw me for a loop.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah.
Rye. I mean, the thing was, when we talk about rye, we're almost talking about it's making a comeback, but rye is kind of this dark horse. My understanding is that before Prohibition, rye was the whiskey, the American whiskey.
It was huge. I assume that it was easier to grow than other grains.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You
know, there has certainly always been, well, in the recent few hundred years, like rye bread and other agricultural uses of rye. But yeah, rye whiskey was much more popular before Prohibition. almost disappeared through the process of prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the last three or four years, it seems to have enjoyed a major resurgence.
There's this, I'll put this in the show notes, but there's this fabulous book on the Budweiser family that kind of takes place. Bitter Brew, it's called. Have you heard of this book?
I've heard of the book. I haven't read it.
It's well written. I'm only partway through it, but it does kind of, it kind of the way that it starts. Although, you know, like a lot of times an author will start with the most exciting part of the story.
Hmm.
And in this case, it was the repeal of prohibition, obviously. Mm-hmm. Huge event. And then kind of goes back and kind of catches you up with how we got here and the fact that, you know, like prior to prohibition, every bar was sponsored by a beer.
Oh.
I.e., the beer company, the brewery would foot the bill for everything, like, you know, but you would only get Budweiser at this bar.
Right.
Or this would be like a Blatz bar or whatever. You know, like it was like that's the only beer you could get.
Right, right. That's interesting. So I read something, I don't remember which book it was, but apparently something similar has persisted in England up to recent times, where you got, there was one or two ales that was produced by one place, and that it was, you know, tantamount to warfare to bring in multiple producers for one bar.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably a fact worth verifying, but
i.e. we don't know what the fuck we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's sometimes it reminds me of and the analogies aren't there, but typically when you go into a cafe that is not a coffee roaster, they're it's the equivalent of that by the roaster who supplies them. Because that roaster will also have an agreement to service the equipment and so forth. Like if it's and Stumptown, certainly they make great coffee, but they'll also service your equipment, train your staff, etc. Yeah. And it reminds me of that how breweries' relationships with bars was.
Hmm.
Although it's different because breweries did not have bars of their own, whereas most roasteries do have their own cafes. But it's it was interesting to me to see that some coffee shops have started selling more than one roastery.
Oh, really? I haven't seen that.
Well, for instance, Barista is in Portland, and they will typically carry several. They'll carry Stumptown, but they'll also carry, you know, Ristretto. They'll carry essentially competing roasters of coffee. And I'm dying to get, you know, Billy from there or something on here to have that conversation because I'm curious, like, so now who services your equipment and like, what? How do you work that arrangement? Is it just directly with La Marzocco or the you know? Luckily, coffee doesn't seem to be going through any kind of prohibition.
That would be your national revolt.
Now, okay, to go briefly back to the subject of water because I'm drunk and I'm running all over the place. I'm pissed because my neighborhood is being torn up so that they can fix the sewers.
Okay. So are there streets that don't have sewer lines?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I just know that there's holes in my street.
Yeah, yeah. So it could be that you're experiencing something similar to what my neighborhood is. So our house is right on the corner of Skidmore and 9th. 9th Street has sewer lines running all along it.
Mm-hmm.
Skidmore has no sewer lines.
Huh.
Okay. So we have a neighbor on Skidmore, and their sewer line runs under their fence toward our house, and in our yard it joins under our house it tees off with your sewer line? It joins with our sewer line.
Okay, I don't think we have that scenario. That's crazy.
Well, it is crazy sounding now, but I think it was surprisingly common.
I could see why.
I mean, you have to build half the infrastructure or 70% of the infrastructure as putting compared with putting it on every street, you know?
Right, right. Well, okay, so we're in Eastmoreland, and there's a massive project undergoing. Like, the whole, like, at least a 10-block area is they're going through. They're actually finished with our street, and they've paved it over now. But this is apparently a massive year or two long project. Do you think this is common, and do you think that Americans are paying enough attention to their infrastructure? Because honestly, right. when I heard about this project, which was unfortunately right after we bought the damn house, or I might have stalled. When I heard about this project, I thought that is incredibly massive, and that must cost Portland a fortune, or me, right. the taxpayer.
Yeah, yeah.
But obviously, no one would embark on this project for fun.
Right. No, that's a perfect point. So, yes, to the answer your questions, I think this is common, and I think that people don't pay enough. I don't think the public understands public infrastructure very well at all. Mm-hmm. And the people working in various utilities have plenty to do, plenty of culpability in that issue. Mm-hmm. You know, particularly in cities like Portland or, you know, major cities, most of the infrastructure, if it hasn't been replaced, needs to be replaced. Mm-hmm. Okay. Many of Portland's pipes, there are plenty of pipes in Portland that date back 80 years or 100 years. Okay. There's a sensible, a rational design life to all infrastructure.
Sure.
You install something now and it's good for 60 or 80 years if you're lucky, mm-hmm. right?
It's just science.
So that has to be replaced.
Yeah.
And it's both expensive and it's disruptive. Mm-hmm. And I don't think elected officials generally make the call on whether or not they're going to raise rates or not. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're going to replace infrastructure, you have to raise rates. Mm-hmm. Because most of what's covered for in rates provides for emergency repairs, you know, which is dealing with the deferred maintenance. Emergency repairs are never as affordable as keeping up with maintenance because they involve overtime. They involve disruptions to businesses and to home life, you know, and it's an impossible situation. And so most communities of any age are dealing with a huge list of deferred maintenance projects. They're dealing with a public that is tired of raising rates, and Portland's a perfect example of that. I mean, we have a measure on the ballot right now about whether or not to pull control of wastewater and drinking water out of city hands and put it into a public utility district. And the main campaign slogan for that effort is, you know, the city has squandered, they have their rates are too high, and they've wasted the resources that they have. And so virtually all municipalities in the country of any size or of any age are dealing with deferred maintenance mm-hmm. and a public perception problem. Mm-hmm. My gut says that municipalities are only now starting to wake up to the need to tell these stories and get the public to understand. But I mean, it's truly difficult. You know, there's all kinds of conversations that are happening right now around this PUD question.
Yeah.
But they're not the relevant questions, in my opinion. We're totally distracted from what are real issues around water provision.
Which are?
You know, there's a long... So Portland developed the Bull Run watershed over 100 years ago. It was the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. When they created a pipeline and established one dam, then they later established a second dam, and since that time they've been selling water to neighboring jurisdictions around Portland. Okay, In a way, this is almost too big a topic to get into in this format, but basically, the ownership and the stewardship and the decisions around all of that long-term infrastructure, previous elected officials and managers have held those decisions tightly, have, in my personal opinion, not distributed the responsibility and the decision-making power amongst wholesale providers as well as they should have. And then there are the kind of silly incidents like with the fluoride. You had counselors making this decision for the public learning about that and reacting to it, and then putting a ballot on the, a measure on the ballot. When Portland voters were deciding about fluoride, 40% of the people who consume Bull Run water had no say in whether or not it should be fluoridated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, regardless of whether you think it should be or not, that's a problem for those people who use Bull Run water. You know, it's disenfranchisement. It's a problem of democracy.
Absolutely. Has your position influenced you politically? Do you feel like you have stronger political views as a result of dealing with water policy?
No, I think I'm inclined to wade into shark-infested waters, which to my
really, own, you are drunk.
To so. My own peril.
Well, tell me this. when Portland was recently the subject of a sequel fiasco of when some punks peed in our water.
Yeah.
My reaction and the reaction of sensible people was, what the hell? The quantity of urine here is probably still less than the pigeon shit in the water,
right.
And among other things.
Totally.
I mean, and I don't think you would disagree. But you had a very measured response of all places on Facebook, not a place to post measured responses to literally anything. But I did read it and appreciate and silently nod my head because shit, if I jumped into that, fucking all of my conservative relatives would be all over it, and I don't want any part of that. But your point was basically about the optics of the scenario, in the words of a political campaignist, that you would say that the city can't not dump the water.
Right.
Explain your position.
Yeah. So
sorry to put you on the spot, but
no,
fuck it.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
That was.
By the way, we can swear here.
Yeah. Okay. Great. damn it. So
you don't have to.
I mean, I think that was basically an option of two bad. Mm-hmm. Solutions, right? I mean,
absolutely. There wasn't a way to win. I totally agree with that, yeah.
And I think that public outcry, it became a national spectacle. I was really surprised.
For a second time, I think it was the first time, too.
Yeah, Wire picked it up, the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Yes, there was almost certainly not a problem with water quality. There was so mm-hmm. little pee, so right. little urine, and yeah. so much water that people were not going to get sick, most likely. The numbers were there, right? And Portland knew that. Okay, Portland had the water tested.
Sure.
Portland
has science.
Portland has science all over the place. Uh-huh. Like, it's scary how well qualified many of the people are who work at Portland.
Right.
And yet all of the public outcry was, those idiots don't know anything about water, And what would have happened if they had said, don't worry, folks, it's going to be fine, okay? I mean, I think my gut says that a handful of people would come out with real or imagined problems, ailments, and say, this is due to water. Mm-hmm. And I am almost certain that there would have been lawsuits about it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very least, and perhaps subconsciously, would be this notion that, a little is okay. A little problem is okay. And when you're charged with drinking water for a community of approximately 900,000 people,
mm-hmm.
you have a different set of factors than a reasonable individual. A reasonable sure. individual understands that dilution creates a non-issue, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. But there's a PR dimension to this that, you know, and PR gets this, well, in my world, gets this rap as being superficial or non-scientific or what have you. But it's a very real and serious issue. And I think that Portland was right to dump the water. The problem is understanding that requires a whole bunch of background information yeah. that you can't get in a newspaper article.
Do you think that am I correct in thinking that Portland is atypical in having non-covered reservoirs of water?
Yes.
Okay. So imagine that there was an uncovered reservoir of this quantity of water. Like, for those at home, he's pouring more whiskey. Now, imagine for a moment that there is an uncovered reservoir in a Southern California city.
Okay.
They can hear it now. It doesn't matter. Santa Barbara, yeah. San Jose.
Yeah, if you're in a drought situation, which
right,
they are,
right?
Then the
do you think they wouldn't have given totally a different. Shit about the piss?
I do, okay. as it were. Yeah, I mean, if you're in a the third year of a drought, and mm-hmm. and if your drinking water reservoirs are at 20% to 40% of what they should be for this time of the season, yes, it's a totally different scenario for Portland. Reservoirs were full and are overflowing, essentially.
Should Portland cover their reservoirs?
Portland is required by court order to cover their reservoirs. And so it's a foregone conclusion. Okay. Portland is doubling the capacity of reservoir, below ground reservoir, at Powell Butte. Mm-hmm. 50 million gallon reservoir is being built right now. The open-air finished water reservoirs in Washington Park and Mount Tabor are going to probably be turned into, aesthetic ponds, like reflecting ponds or something like that. But you will no longer be able to pee in the water supply.
What do you think it would happen if someone threw something into the water that was unidentified? Like took a ball of paper and threw it in there. Like, what is it about peeing? And why is it peeing? Why is it always peeing? What if someone, like, threw something that could plausibly have been a bunch of acid in there? Like,
right, right. You could make it dangerous, and that would be a problem. And, if it was a ball of paper, I don't know how Portland would respond. But
it'd be interesting to see, huh? Wait for the movie.
Wait for the movie. Good advice.
Yeah, well, yeah. Jesse, thanks for talking to me today.
Hey, well, nice talking with you.
All right. Cheers. We should stop there because it's probably not making...
This is one of the things I love about Need More is the fact that we eat donuts whenever we launch a website.
You weren't here for the other donuts.
What other donuts? You already had donuts?
No, well, last week or whatever for a different thing we had...
Yeah, I missed the donuts.
Blue Star Donuts.
I thought there would be maybe like a donut on my desk. Or like a
they don't stay fresh that long, so I was forced to eat some more.
A donut that came home with somebody.
You were sick. You'd have probably thrown it up.
I will eat donuts.
Sit there licking the frosting.
Feverish.
All right, well, I don't know. Yeah. Okay, let's go.
Let's get donuts. Are we? So we're not going to talk about the new project. We're just gonna eat some donuts and... You were so excited about Git that we didn't even get to our new project.
Talk about
and
our new
and
project.
Agile and all that. Well, people want to listen to Jesse. Let's just listen to Jesse. So much more interesting than...
I'm probably putting all this after it anyway.
Okay.
All right.
Goodwitch.
Yes.
So there are a couple of things that I'm excited about with this project.
Uh-huh.
One is it was our first foray into... a more agile approach? Is that the
way it is? It was extremely agile.
Yeah.
I don't think it would fit into any agile practice that I've heard of, but I would describe the overall process as very, very agile.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we basically had,
like, in a good way,
1 week from start to finish to make the website. And although we invited the client to come in anytime during the week and kind of see where we were in the process, she was pretty hands-off in terms of, I think, design, very specific about what content needed to be on the page. But I think that gave us the freedom to jump in, and I don't know, it felt like a kind of like, I don't know, when I was writing about, I was thinking about writing a song. It felt like we would, like, come up with some ideas and work with them and then step back and think about them. And it was very iterative instead of, like, here's a mock-up, now we're making the mock, you know. It felt really good. Like, it felt creative. And that site is lovely. It's a, just a quirky, small little, but also you have a history with Good Witch's founder.
Uh-huh. I knew her from when she worked at Red and Black, which is now not Red and Black.
Yeah.
Long time ago. She used to serve me coffee.
It's nice to work with old
friends. No, she's great. You know? She's hilarious.
Yeah, it's sweet.
She came in, she told me this lengthy story about how someone dropped a family heirloom in a you know, one of those, like, urinals in a public forest park thing? And how another gentleman who was camping with had to hold the guy upside down to fish out there? I do not believe this story.
You know, so we were camping recently.
Who would do that? You know, when we went camping, I looked. I don't think a man would fit through there.
No, I actually considered how you could get somebody out, because our youngest was convinced that she wanted to try going potty on the urinal.
Oh, my God.
And I was so afraid that she was going to fall in that, like, in my mind, I was like, can you rescue somebody once they've fallen in?
I didn't want to think about
it. And I decided it just wasn't worth the... It wasn't worth it, so we didn't do it. But I was kind of scoping it out, like, okay, so worst case scenario, she falls in. Can I retrieve her? Mm. It's the same thing like when we were at the river. Mm. Worst case, she falls into the river.
Yeah,
retrievable? Yes or no? No, let's move back a little bit. You know, cool. So donuts. Let's go.
All right, let's go get donuts.